All right, so imagine this. You're looking at a state constitution, and it says in black and white that all men are free and independent. Pretty clear, right? You'd think that would be that. Case closed.
It's straightforward enough.
But what if I told you those words, those very powerful words, didn't actually change the reality for everyone in that state?
Well, that's where things get interesting, isn't it?
It is. And that's exactly what we're diving into today. We're going to be looking at this fascinating case from 19th century New Jersey State v. Post, 1845, where we see that tension play out in the courtroom. You know, you shared some really insightful stuff about constitutional interpretation, about the history of abolition, and this case really brings all of that into sharp focus. It shows you how those lofty ideals, those big ideas about freedom, sometimes slam right into the brick wall of existing legal realities.
It's like looking at legal history under a microscope, this case, State v. Post. It really lays bare the friction, that push and pull between those grand principles, those beautiful ideas about rights, and the way laws actually operate in the real world, with real people's lives hanging in the balance.
And in this case, the real people are John Post, who is detaining a 60-year-old man, William. And the prosecution is coming in saying, nope, that's illegal now. New Jersey's got this brand new constitution from 1844. It says everyone is free and independent, so slavery is over. But then you have Post and his lawyers firing back saying, hold on a minute, my right to own William is still perfectly valid under the laws that existed before this new constitution came along. I mean, wow, talk about a constitutional showdown, right?
Yeah, it's a textbook example, no pun intended, of how even the most fundamental language in a constitution, the very bedrock of a state's legal system, can be challenged, can be put to the test when it bumps up against the weight, the inertia of long-standing legal practices. It's a story about continuity and change, about how those two forces collide.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what we're digging into today. So, our mission, our goal in this deep dive, isn't just to recount the facts of the case, you know, who did what, who said what. We want to go deeper. We want to understand why a statement as powerful as all men are free and independent didn't immediately flip the switch and end slavery in New Jersey. What does that tell us about how courts grapple with fundamental rights, how they interpret those big ideas? And you'll see, it's a journey that reveals just how deeply rooted certain laws can be. And how complex, how winding the road to legal change often is.
That's rarely a straight line.
Rarely a straight line. So let's rewind a bit, set the stage. New Jersey, in the early 1800s, they weren't exactly, what, leading the charge for immediate abolition, were they?
Not exactly, no. New Jersey was moving toward ending slavery, but they were taking a much more gradual approach, kind of phased approach. Like many states at the time, they were wrestling with this huge moral and social issue, trying to figure out how to unwind centuries of deeply ingrained practices.
And a lot of economic interest tied up in it too, right?
Absolutely. So in 1804, and then again in 1820, they passed these laws that were, in theory, supposed to lead to the eventual end of slavery, but it was this slow, drawn-out process. Take the 1804 law, for instance, and said, okay, any child born to an enslaved mother after July 4th of that year, they'll be free. But there's a catch, right? There's always a
It's
catch.
always a catch, yeah.
These children, even though they were legally free, they were still required to serve their mother's owner as indentured servants for a really long time, like until they turn 25 if they were female or 21 if they were male. So, yeah, free in name, but not exactly free in practice.
Freedom with an asterisk.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so for those of us, you know, maybe not fully up on all the legal distinctions here, indentured servitude, is it fair to say it's different from outright slavery in that it's got that defined end date? But it still involves forced labor, right? It's still this system of compelled service.
That's the crucial difference. Yeah, indentured servitude, while still a form of unfree labor, it's not the same as chattel slavery, which was generally seen as a lifetime condition, a permanent state of being owned. With indentured servitude, there's at least that light at the end of the tunnel. There's a predetermined endpoint, a date when the contract, so to speak, expires. But yeah, it still involves a huge loss of autonomy. It's still a system where people are forced to work against their will.
Right, so a step toward freedom, but a very long, very slow step.
Okay.
Okay, the other big thing here, this is key for understanding the Post case, is that these gradual abolition laws in New Jersey, they didn't apply to anyone who was born before that 1804 cutoff, right? So if you were already enslaved before that date, well, your legal status didn't change one bit. The 1820 law made some tweaks to the gradual emancipation process, but the bottom line remained the same. A significant portion of the population in New Jersey was still legally considered enslaved under state law when that 1844 Constitution came along. That's the backdrop, the legal and social landscape where State v. Post plays out.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And it's important to remember that this wasn't happening in a vacuum, right? You had the abolition movement gaining momentum, moral arguments against slavery intensifying. So you have these legal changes happening alongside this growing social and political pressure.
Yeah, this pressure cooker of change. Okay, so then we get to this pivotal moment, this turning point, the 1844 Constitution, Article 1, Section 1, boom. All men are by nature free and independent and have certain natural and unalienable rights, including, and this is key, life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. I mean, come on, that's a pretty powerful, pretty sweeping statement, isn't it? It feels almost self-evident, like a truth being proclaimed to the world.
It does. And that's exactly what the abolitionists, those who were fighting tooth and nail to end slavery, latched onto. This language became their rallying cry in State v. Post. They argued forcefully that this Declaration of Natural Rights, now enshrined in the state's most foundational legal document, the Constitution itself, well, it inherently automatically made the practice of slavery illegal. It was like, game over. The Constitution trumps all other laws. And they argued that these newly recognized fundamental rights had to take precedence over any previous laws that allowed for the ownership of other human beings. It was a direct challenge to the status quo, a bold move to leverage the power of the Constitution to dismantle this institution of slavery.
Yeah, they were basically saying this is a new era. This is the law of the land now. Okay, so that's the argument rooted in principle in those fundamental human rights. But on the other side, you've got John Post. He's holding William, this 60-year-old man, and he's not backing down. What was his legal argument? How did he justify continuing to own another person in the face of what seemed like pretty clear constitutional language?
Post's argument, it was all about the technicalities, the specifics of the existing legal framework. His legal team zeroed in on one crucial fact, that the 1844 Constitution, as sweeping as it was, didn't explicitly directly repeal those older laws, those statutes that had for a long time recognized and regulated slavery in New Jersey. They basically said, look, the Constitution may talk about freedom in general terms, but it doesn't mention slavery specifically. And it doesn't say in so many words that those old laws are null and void. And they specifically pointed to the 1798 Act, which had basically cemented the legal status of those who were already enslaved. Their argument boiled down to this. Unless those specific laws, those statutes, were explicitly, clearly wiped off the books by the new Constitution, they remained valid. They remained in force. And therefore, they argued, those laws continued to protect Post's claim of ownership over William, who, as we know, was born before that critical 1804 cutoff date.
So it was this head-to-head clash.
Huh.
On one side, you've got this broad, sweeping statement about natural rights. And on the other, you've got the nitty-gritty details of specific, long-standing laws. And the court had to decide, does that general principle automatically overrule all those specific older laws? What did they rule?
Well, the New Jersey Supreme Court, in a majority opinion written by Justice Nevius, ended up siding with Post.
Yeah.
They ruled that, no, the 1844 Constitution by itself did not abolish slavery in New Jersey.
I mean, that might seem surprising to some, given how clear that constitutional language sounds. So break it down for us. What was their logic? Why did they interpret the Constitution that way?
So there were several key reasons for their decision, all kind of intertwined. First, they made this really important distinction, a legal distinction that's still relevant today, between what they called general and declarative language about basic political rights and very specific legal directives, the kind that would be needed to overturn existing laws governing things like private property. And to them, the free and independent clause, it was a powerful statement, sure, but they saw it as more of a general principle, a kind of aspirational statement about how the state should operate, not as this precise legal command that would automatically invalidate those existing laws dealing with property, including, unfortunately in this case, property in the form of enslaved people. Justice Nevius, he actually said it pretty directly. This is a key quote. Had the convention intended to abolish slavery, it would have adopted some clear and definite provision. He was saying, if they wanted to end slavery, they would have said so explicitly.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's like if a company has a mission statement about being eco-friendly, right?
Yeah.
Sounds great, but without specific policies, without concrete rules about recycling and emissions, that mission statement doesn't actually change how they operate. It's a nice idea, but it doesn't have the legal teeth to force them to change their practices overnight.
Exactly. It's about the difference between aspirations and concrete legal mechanisms.
Okay, so that's one reason they saw that constitutional language is more of a general principle, not a specific legal instruction. What else swayed them?
Well, the second big factor was history, legal history. They emphasized that slavery, unfortunately, had this long, deep-rooted history in New Jersey, going all the way back to colonial times. There were all these laws, all these statutes on the books that recognized and regulated it. And the court basically said, look, this institution of slavery, it's been around for a long time. It's been woven into the fabric of our legal system. You can't just overturn something like that with a general statement, however powerful it may sound. You need very specific, explicit language to undo something that's been so ingrained in the law.
Like trying to unravel a really tangled knot.
Yeah, exactly. Then their third point was that the 1844 Constitution itself, if you look at it closely, well, it doesn't contain any clear, unambiguous language saying we are hereby abolishing slavery. It doesn't directly address the issue or say all those old laws about slavery, they're now repealed. And the court, they put a lot of weight on that. They believe that if the framers of the Constitution had intended to make such a huge change, such a fundamental shift, well, they would have spelled it out clearly and directly. It wouldn't have been left to implication or interpretation.
It's like they were looking for that smoking gun, that clear statement of intent. Okay, so that's three reasons. Any others?
There's one more that's kind of interesting. They looked beyond New Jersey, beyond their own borders, to other states, other legal precedents. And they pointed out that other state constitutions, like Virginia and Vermont, they also had these free and independent clauses, these broad statements about natural rights. And guess what? Those clauses hadn't been interpreted by their courts as automatically ending slavery either. So they were saying, look, this isn't just how we interpret this kind of language. It's consistent with how other courts have approached similar constitutional provisions.
So they were placing their decision within a larger legal context. New Jersey wasn't going rogue here.
Right. They were saying this is how it's generally understood.
Okay. So that's a majority opinion. But were all the judges on board with that?
Mm-hmm.
Did everyone agree with Justice Nevius?
Well, not quite. It wasn't a unanimous decision. You had Justice Randolph. He agreed with the outcome, so he concurred with the majority. But he had a slightly different take on things. His argument was that the free and independent clause, it was more like a preamble, a kind of aspirational statement of principles and goals for the state, but not really a legally enforceable provision that could directly invalidate those existing laws. He saw it more as a guiding philosophy, a set of ideals to strive for, rather than a concrete legal command you could use to overturn specific statutes.
More like a North Star than a roadmap.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
And Justice Carpenter, he also joined the majority. So that's two concurrences. But then you have Chief Justice Hornblower. He dissented. He disagreed with the majority.
Ah, so there was some pushback.
Yeah, there was. Now, the historical record, unfortunately, it doesn't go into great detail about his specific reasoning. We don't have a fully fleshed out dissenting opinion from him to analyze. But the fact that he dissented at all is significant. It tells us that there was at least one prominent legal voice on the court who held a different view, who saw things differently. And it's probably safe to assume, given the context, that his dissent was rooted in a more expansive, more rights-focused view of the Constitution, one that was probably more sympathetic to those abolitionist arguments.
So even within the court, there were different perspectives on how to interpret this constitutional language. It wasn't a slam dunk. But ultimately, the majority ruled that the Constitution by itself didn't have the power to end slavery in New Jersey. So zoom out with us for a second. What were the bigger consequences of that decision? What does State v. Post mean for us today, looking back on it from a historical perspective? What's its lasting significance?
Well, on a really fundamental level, I think it highlights the limitations, the challenges of relying solely on broad constitutional principles, however noble they may be, to achieve really sweeping social change. It shows that you need more than just grand pronouncements about rights. The court's decision in Post, it's a stark reminder that without clear, specific legal mechanisms, without laws that directly address the issue at hand, there's deeply entrenched legal and social structures, those systems of power, they can be incredibly resistant to change, even when confronted with seemingly progressive constitutional declarations. It shows that good intentions, those aspirational ideals, they might not be enough to dismantle those long-standing legal realities, especially when there are powerful interests vested in maintaining the status quo.
Yeah, it's a reminder that laws are tools, and sometimes you need the right tool for the job, so to speak. Okay, so big picture stuff aside, what happened on the ground in New Jersey after this ruling? Did slavery just continue as before, business as usual?
Sadly, yes, pretty much. State v. Post meant that slavery remained legal in New Jersey, at least for those who were already enslaved before those gradual abolition laws kicked in. And think about that. It wasn't until the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which was ratified in 1865, a full 2 decades after this New Jersey case, that slavery was finally completely abolished nationwide, including in New Jersey. So for 20 years, people continued to be enslaved in New Jersey, even though the state constitution said all men are free. It's a pretty sobering thought, right? It shows the very real, tangible impact of that court decision.
Definitely gives you pause. Okay, so switching gears a bit, thinking about our listeners who are studying law, maybe just starting out, what are the key takeaways from State v. Post for someone trying to understand how our legal system operates? What are those core legal lessons embedded in this case?
There's a lot to unpack here, but I think a couple of things really stand out. First, it really underscores this crucial difference, this fundamental legal distinction between explicit rights and implied rights. Courts, they tend to be pretty cautious, pretty hesitant when it comes to overturning longstanding laws based on what they see as implied interpretations of broad constitutional language. They're usually looking for that clear, unambiguous mandate within the text itself, within the words of the law, to justify invalidating existing statutes.
But they're not big on reading between the lines. They want it spelled out.
Generally speaking, yeah. And then the second big lesson here, it has to do with these two very different, sometimes competing, approaches to law, legal positivism and natural law. These are big ideas in legal philosophy, and Post is a great example of how they play out in the real world. Think of it this way. Legal positivism, it basically says, look, the law is what's written down. The law is the text, the statutes, the precedents. It's all about what's codified, what's formally enacted. Natural law, on the other hand, it takes a different stance. It says there are these inherent moral principles, these fundamental ideas about justice and rights that should inform and maybe even override those written laws.
So one is about what's on the books, and the other is about a higher law. A law may be rooted in morality or reason.
Exactly. And the abolitionists in State v. Post, their argument was very much grounded in natural law. They were appealing to these fundamental notions of human rights, of freedom and equality, to challenge the validity of those pro-slavery statutes. But the court, in its decision, leaned heavily toward legal positivism. They prioritized those existing statutes, those written laws, over those broader, more abstract principles of natural rights that were expressed in that constitutional language.
So even though the Constitution said all men are free, the court, in essence, said, well, the specific laws about slavery are still on the books, so that's what we have to follow.
In a nutshell, yeah. It's a classic example of that tension between those two philosophies of law.
Fascinating stuff. Okay, so you talked about modern parallels earlier. How does this 19th century case from New Jersey, this legal battle over slavery, how does it connect to the kinds of legal discussions we're having today? Does it still have relevance?
Absolutely, it does. One way it's still relevant is in these ongoing debates about what some legal scholars call the penumbras of rights. These are those implied rights, those rights that aren't explicitly listed out in the Constitution, but they're seen as kind of emanating from, flowing from, those rights that are specifically enumerated.
So rights that are hinted at, but not spelled out directly.
Right. Like the right to privacy, for example. Think about landmark cases like Roe v. Wade. Just like those abolitionists in State v. Post argued for an implied right to freedom based on that broad language in the New Jersey Constitution, a lot of contemporary legal arguments, they revolve around whether certain rights are implicitly protected by the Constitution's text, by its overall structure and logic. So in a way, they're trying to do what the abolitionists tried to do, use those broader principles to expand the scope of our rights.
So they're saying it may not say it directly, but the spirit of the Constitution, the principles underlying it, they point toward these other rights.
Right. And State v. Post serves as this really important historical reminder of the challenges, the hurdles involved in persuading courts to recognize and enforce those kinds of implied rights, especially when they bump up against those long-standing legal precedents and when they encounter judges who are more comfortable with that more literal, more text-based approach to constitutional interpretation.
Right. So history shows us it's an uphill battle. It's not enough to say, well, it should be a right. You have to convince the courts that it's grounded in the law, in the text, in the precedents. Okay, so bring it all home, tying it all together even today, just having those big, beautiful statements of principle in our founding documents. That's not always a guarantee of immediate, sweeping societal change. Those words, they need to be translated into concrete legal mechanisms, and a lot depends on how those broad principles are interpreted by the courts.
Couldn't have said it better myself. State v. Post is a case study, a historical lesson, in the complexities of legal change, and it reminds us that even the most powerful declarations of freedom, they might not be enough to instantly dismantle those deep-rooted legal and social structures, those systems that have been built up over time. It highlights just how crucial that specific legal language is, and it shows us this ongoing tension, this constant push and pull between our aspirations, our ideals for a just society, and the practical realities of how the law is actually applied, how it works in the real world.
And that tension, I think, that's what makes this case and this whole period of history so fascinating. It's this struggle between what is and what should be. And it's a struggle that's still playing out today, in different forms and different contexts. So, leaving our listeners with something to ponder, think about the court's reasoning in State v. Post. Do you think they were just faithfully applying the existing legal framework, doing their job as judges, interpreting the law as they saw it? Or was their decision a missed opportunity, a chance to take a bolder stand, to really advance the cause of human liberty by embracing a broader, more morally driven interpretation of the Constitution?
It's a tough question. And thinking about it, it raises another question. What does this case tell us about the role, the responsibility of different branches of government in bringing about meaningful, lasting social change? The courts, the legislature, the executive branch, they all have a part to play.
And State v. Post is a powerful reminder that those interactions, that interplay between different parts of our government, well, they can have profound consequences for how our rights are defined, how they're protected, and how our society ultimately evolves. We've just scratched the surface here, and there's so much more to explore about the legal battles surrounding abolition and about how our understanding of constitutional rights has changed over time. But hopefully this deep dive has given you a glimpse into those complexities and maybe even sparked some curiosity to dig deeper on your own.
And that's what it's all about, right? Asking those tough questions and never stopping the learning process.
Exactly. So until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep those legal minds sharp.